Welcome to Social Work Stories, a podcast exploring social work practice through stories and critical reflection. This podcast is recorded on Aboriginal country, which was never ceded. We acknowledge the traditional custodians and cultural knowledge holders of these lands and pay our respects to Aboriginal elders past, present, and emerging. We offer a warm welcome to any Indigenous listeners who are part of our podcast community around the world. If you have thoughts or feedback for our team, or just want to find our whole back catalog of episodes, check out our website, socialworkstories.com. But for now, on with the episode.
Hello everyone, welcome to the Social Work Stories podcast. I'm Mim Fox and I am so grateful to be sitting opposite my wonderful friend and colleague Liz Murphy. Hi Liz.
Hello Mim and hello everyone. And are you feeling grateful to be sitting opposite me because I'm not doing accreditation with you? I'm actually just having a nice conversation with you. Is that why?
Do you know Liz, I've sat across many people the last few days. We've just had our professional accreditation for our university. And for those of you who are our international listeners in Australia, all social work programs are accredited every 5 years by our professional association. I know it's different in different countries. And I think no matter where you are in the world, it's always a bit of a tricky scenario having to represent your program and the beautiful things that you do. I mean, honestly, Liz, unless someone comes and sits in my classroom and watches what happens, I genuinely don't think they ever get the complete picture.
No, they wouldn't, Mim. And did they? Did they come and sit in your classroom?
They didn't sit in the classroom, but they did speak to students and they spoke to our field educators and our employers and all the wonderful people involved in the program. And I have to say, I've never been prouder of the programs that I work within. I think that we do a fabulous job, as I know so many programs out there do. We are really across the board, we are producing fabulous graduates, and I'm just really proud of us in this country for what we produce and do.
So you'd only be speaking like this if you knew that you went well, or we got the thumbs up? Have you got the
we
thumbs up?
We got the
up?
Thumbs up.
Oh,
it's all
congratulations.
Good.
A virtual pop of champagne going on here. And what a way to celebrate, Mim. You finish accreditation and then you record a podcast episode. Wow.
Well, it's just an extension of, it's the enactment of what I've said I do for the last few days. And it's my happy place and my comfort zone, Liz. So more than happy, as always, to be in conversation with you, my friend.
Likewise. So what have we got in store for our wonderful listeners today, Mim?
So this is a really interesting one. A couple of years ago now, I was approached by a social worker from Melbourne called Felicity Moon. And Felicity's a long-term hospital social worker who was really interested in this concept of discharge planning. As you know, Liz, I mean, we've spoken about discharge planning at many different points on the podcast. It's one of the key interventions that social workers, or I wouldn't even say intervention, I would say, task or activity that social workers are involved with in the hospital setting. And whether it's an intervention is part of the discussion and part of the thing that Felicity is so interested in. So she came to me and said, I'm interested in doing a deep dive exploration on what discharge planning is. I'm thinking about starting with some literature and really getting to the bottom of that. And she wanted to know, what does discharge planning really define as, what do we think about it as, but also as social workers, how do we enact that? Are there theories? Are there practices? What do we do? And is it, because it's so core to hospital social work, right? And I thought, you know what, Liz, I'm always up for a deep dive.
Oh.
I'm always up. You know I am.
always. And I bet you just thought, this is fantastic, a scoping review as well as a discussion about discharge planning. I mean, does it get any better than this, Mim?
That's it. So we did what's called a scoping review, which is a systematic, one of the many forms of a systematic literature review. And we have an article being considered for publication at the moment. And so Felicity thought she might come onto the podcast and talk to everyone today about what that research she did actually meant for her in her practice and what it means about how we think about or conceptualize discharge planning as part of our toolkit of tasks and activities that we're involved with. So let's have a listen, Liz. And one of the big warnings we do have to do is that Felicity is fabulous, but she is also a hospital social worker, which means that she talks fast. So we've asked Ben, our fantastic producer, to maybe try and slow Felicity down slightly. We don't know if that's going to be successful or not, so we hope that you will all actually go with the vibe that Felicity gives, which is of a fast-paced hospital, and hear the pearls and wisdoms within, because, gosh, she has a lot to share, Liz.
Hello, my name is Felicity. I've been a social worker for 13 years, always in hospitals, mainly working with adult patients in medical units, particularly general medicine and the emergency department. And when I went for my final placement interview, which was going to be in a hospital, I remember being asked about what I thought social workers do in hospitals, and I had absolutely no idea. We weren't taught specifically about hospital social work, to my recollection, at uni. And while we did cover biopsychosocial assessments, there was no specific mention of discharge planning. And as I was exposed to different medical units and areas in the hospital during placement and practice, it became clear that while there is some crossover and transferability of skills and the types of health and psychosocial issues that patients and their families are experiencing, discharge planning interventions are more common in some areas rather than others. And I distinctly remember someone quite early on making the comment that they wouldn't want to work in a particular medical unit as it's, quote, just discharge planning. And I think what they meant is it's just doing referrals to home help or community services. It's just paperwork. There's no kind of real interpersonal work. And so I ended up working for several years in adult general medicine, or gen med as it tends to be called, which is a unit that specializes in treatment for patients presenting with multi-system issues, multiple comorbidities. So not just one specific illness or condition or medical problem or organ system or body part, it's anything and everything. And often the patients admitted to general medicine have complex psychosocial issues, which I know we say for all units, but they tend to be older patients who require complex discharge planning. And everything I learned about discharge planning, I learned on the job, and I was very fortunate over the years to work with some amazing social work colleagues and supervisors and team leaders. And there's also this emphasis, this need to use evidence-based practice. So how do we know we're actually providing a high quality of intervention? And when we are doing discharge planning, we are often involved in making significant decisions for people and their families. So it needs to be evidence-based. Being admitted to hospital is a crisis, and yet unfortunately, as a result of changes to physical function or general health, it's also the time where people have to make really difficult decisions about their future, and that's particularly the case for our older patients and their families in situations where, due to those biopsychosocial vulnerabilities such as cognitive impairments and dementia, falls and mobility issues, or medical factors, that mean that their assistance not being safe to return home, or their carers might no longer be able to support them to return home safely. And so you could add in family conflict or issues around decision making, and that's when it becomes quite complex and often requires intensive input from social workers and the members of the multidisciplinary team. And so I can remember multiple cases that I've been involved in where, as a social worker, you're placed in a really difficult position as being there to advocate for the patient and families who, in their heart, obviously want to go home. They want life to go back to normal. But there's clinical evidence that being discharged home is not in their best interest. It's not safe. So one case that stays with me involved a woman who was probably in her 80s with quite severe dementia, and she'd come in one morning and the ambulance report has said she'd had a fall and been on the floor all night. And it was during that presentation after she fell that her family made the really difficult decision for her that she required placement in aged care, and it was more distressing for them than it was for the patient. There were really huge issues around grief and loss. And so that's often the thing with these cases, is often you're providing really intensive support, more sometimes to the family than the patient themselves. It's not just about finding a residential aged care facility and doing the paperwork. It's about addressing the psychosocial component of that adjustment. And it's interesting sometimes the perceptions we form about what social work is going to be like in different medical settings. We tend to associate some units with more therapeutic or emotionally orientated interventions, or what we could consider meaning-making activities and counselling. There are some settings where discharge planning as a distinct category of intervention isn't really done to the same extent as units like general medicine. So, for example, ICU or patients having dialysis or outpatients, you're not really doing discharge planning in the traditional sense of the word. So it's more concentrated in some units rather than others. And I can't remember exactly what sparked the idea, but it dawned on me that it would be worthwhile or useful to establish what social workers actually do, as in how do we define discharge planning as opposed to other interventions, and what makes good social work discharge planning? What are the metrics or qualities that we would be addressing, or we want to address specific to social work when we're doing discharge planning? And it's obviously not just a social work activity. Discharge planning is hospital-wide. And so you get the quality of discharges generally assessed in relation to organisational and bureaucratic indicators like length of stay. And sometimes that's where our values actually clash. I remember a case involving a relatively young man who was in the middle of relocating to Melbourne. And he pulled into our emergency department, or the emergency department where I was working at the time, because of something ambiguous like chest pain or breathlessness. Anyway, there was this rapid chain of events and he was diagnosed with a metastatic illness, cancer, that's spread, and he had a really poor prognosis. But he was medically cleared relatively quickly, and he didn't need any acute treatment in hospital. He was independent with his mobility, but he had no accommodation and he wasn't ready for hospice. He wasn't end stage. He didn't have a significant symptom burden that required inpatient palliative care. He was too young for aged care, he didn't qualify for disability accommodation, and it certainly wasn't appropriate to send him to a boarding house. So it was incredibly traumatic for him, horrible situation for him. And so in these cases, it was so as a social worker, you have to deal with a lot of the elements. So in, you know, the patient inside the hospital and their journey, what they're going through emotionally and psychologically and the uncertainty, but also needing to really look at what's available in the community within kind of the context of focusing on discharges. So initially I sent out to do a systematic review because I wanted to evaluate the types of interventions and look at efficacy, but a systematic review didn't really work because I quickly discovered discharge planning as a term is operationalized and used very differently, and it's often not defined clearly. And to do a systematic review, you need to compare concepts or interventions that are quite clear and measurable. So I spotted the methodology to a scoping review to flesh out how discharge planning is actually conceptualized and characterized in the literature. What activities fall under discharge planning? Is doing assessments and counseling part of discharge planning, or are they entirely separate? Because it feels like we're talking about different things. So I reached out to Associate Professor Fiona McDermott and Dr. Mim Fox to set up a team to do this review. And I also had the pleasure of having a social work student with me last year, Mr. Long Nguyen, who was doing his final placement. And as part of that, worked with me to go through our search results and screen papers based on the inclusion-exclusion criteria. And you end up reading a lot of material you don't actually need, but it's really interesting. It's good learning nevertheless. And it took several weeks, but we finally had a total sample of papers, so both published and unpublished literature that evidence got social work discharge planning in terms of how it's conceptualized and characterized. And one of the striking things about how discharge planning was written about in the literature was that, as expected, it was defined differently in most papers. So if we break down what we do as discharge planning as social workers, we label activity like counselling, liaison, referrals, family meetings, resourcing, advocacy, service coordination, case management. But when it comes to what is and isn't discharge planning, it really depended on how the individual paper would define it. Some papers argued it was a distinct intervention, so different from counselling or liaison. Others argued it was the overarching focus of all hospital social work, so it included counselling, referrals and service coordination. And the reason that this is important is particularly, I guess, if you're trying to teach or evaluate, we need to know what we're trying to convey and achieve. And it can be difficult to design effective interventions if we're actually referring to different things. And again, what was striking is that although discharge planning is very much not viewed as a therapeutic activity in the same way as counselling interventions would be. So discharge planning as an activity was associated with service coordination to facilitate discharge. So it sounds quite dry and mechanical and bureaucratic and transactional. And it wasn't really specified as such, but theoretically we could probably see the relevance of your systems theories, which have also been criticised for being mechanical, even in terms of the jargon we use when we're applying the concepts. So whereas counselling interventions, on the other hand, are probably more appealing, maybe because they're so richly human. And the other aspect is that the quality of the success, I guess, of discharge planning is dependent on external resources that are often disconnected from the hospital, whereas the work of counselling and meaning making or emotional support is usually quite collaborative. And often that person is directly in front of us or connected to us in some way, like over the phone or telehealth or what have you. But This actually highlights the complexity of discharge work and suggests it does require specialist knowledge and skills, because there's immense power involved in being able to support patients and families to navigate systems and to facilitate adjustment in the community, just set them up for adjustment in the community in the long term. And it does in many ways resemble specialist practice, because you need this encyclopedia of services in your mind, like eligibility criteria, and you often need to get you often need to advocate to get their needs met when they do leave hospital. And in terms of the decision making involved with discharge planning, often we're working with people, as I said, with cognitive impairments or dementias, and there's conflict about where someone should go from hospital. You could argue even that maybe applying for guardianship and administration orders, so their legal interventions, is actually a component broadly of discharge planning, as it's orientated towards that endpoint of where someone goes after hospital and what decisions need to be made. And I remember a case a few years ago working with a woman who was in her 50s, and she was admitted to hospital due to complications from substance dependence, and she was homeless, and it was new homelessness. So again, from a medical perspective, once she went through withdrawal, she was medically fine, but there was obvious issues with her cognition and her ability to make decisions. So decisions about what kind of accommodation she needed and the insight around her own needs. And the issue from a medical perspective was, it was due to, I guess, the nature of addiction and its impact on the body and the brain. There was suspicion of encephalopathy and delirium. And so it was difficult to get an assessment of her decision-making capacity, because it was fluctuating so much. So any decisions were contingent on her having decision-making capacity. And as a social worker, it involved a lot of liaison and collaboration with different specialties inside the hospital. And we did trial least restrictive discharge planning, I think, to a supported residential service. And she did lack capacity, and unfortunately it didn't work. But standing back, that whole case from the get-go was about where she will go from hospital, taking into account her health needs, her social issues, and most importantly, what we think she wanted for herself. How do we preserve that? It involved multiple points of assessment, consultation with a family, consultation with neuropsychology and multiple medical physicians, including, you know, geriatrics, rehabilitation, general medicine, addiction medicine, gastroenterology, psychiatry. It involves searching the community for appropriate accommodation options, so service coordination. And obviously for her, there were emotional needs around the loss of her autonomy, her life in the community, and the adjustment to being in hospital, you know, the routine and the rigidity of being in hospital, this unfamiliar environment with very unfamiliar people. And within this, as this dynamic is going on, there's this constant pressure to find a discharge destination, because she technically was medically stable. So again, it just highlights, as part of discharge planning, we're responsible for these really huge decisions for people who are quite vulnerable. And so I got back in touch with my student Long Nguyen, who is now working in general medicine in another hospital, and asked him to reflect about, from his perspective, what his experience has been working, doing discharge planning, versus what we did in the scoping review, and how the findings relate to kind of real life, if you will. And he did find that in general medicine, discharge planning has strong dominance in practice, and he spends himself doing his time is spent on doing what we would define as discharge planning. And it is a specialist practice, and you do need the skills and knowledge for effective discharge planning, particularly knowledge of available services and how the service systems work. And most importantly, he's found the ability to explain complex service systems in simple language and provide initial guidance to patients and families upon discharge, for example. He often spends time explaining My Aged Care, how home care packages work, or crisis accommodation catchments to patients and families. In terms of the advocacy and power involved in discharge planning, he often finds himself advocating for patients when submitting referrals for services in the community and making sure that he's providing all the necessary information, so really detailed assessments around the patient, as well as explaining to patients why they would specifically benefit from this service. So, for example, when submitting a referral to post-acute care, the social worker needs to contact the intake team to confirm the catchment and provide an overview of the patient's circumstances, the needs, and why the patient would benefit from the service, as well as just making the referral. So again, it's not just simply submitting a referral, there's advocacy involved. So I hope this presentation has been interesting. I obviously feel very strongly about the importance of discharge planning and what social workers can contribute, and the possibility for discharge planning to be an intervention that is imbued with the broader values of the profession, such as achieving social justice. Thank you.
Liz, now that we've come through the fast-paced telling from Felicity about settling us down into hospital social work and discharge planning, what are your first impressions?
Lots, but I'm going to start with how much I enjoyed it, because when I think about it, discharge planning has been a huge part of my work as a social worker, right? But what it's helped me to do is to really examine the importance that it really has. And I don't think I have given it the credit that it deserves. And I really loved how Felicity talked about how the scholarly articles, I guess, pitched discharge planning. And the one that really caught my attention was that it is an umbrella term, essentially, for all the work that is done by a hospital social worker with their patient and the patient's family, right? And so that, I kind of felt my brain expand slightly on that one. And when you look at it from that perspective, it actually elevates the practice so much more. And when I think about how social workers work in this space, I thought it was really interesting that she ended with the commentary on that it actually represents, like, social work, if we bring our values to it, and especially the value of social justice, it is, when you think about the importance of discharge in the life of our patients and how important it is to support them in their independence, to support them in their transition to somewhere else, to support them in their reactions and their meaning making around the discharge. And then the other thing that comes up for me, Mim, is the complications that can occur. Like, if you think, she said, discharge planning is beyond, often we'll just go straight to referral to services. And even if you left it at that, right?
Like, yeah.
Like, I think about how important that alone is, let alone all the other things, yeah, she described. When you think about, it's one thing to say, yeah, I'll refer them to, let's just go for home care, right? I'm going to refer this person to home care. Every social worker knows that you can make the referral all you want, but most often than not, there isn't a service there for them. So there was no kind of discussion about how tricky that is, but that's another pivotal role that social work plays. there is limited amount of services for our patients when they're being discharged. And we have to get really creative, right, Mim?
Like, yeah.
I feel like sometimes it's like sewing together a patchwork quilt with the amount of services that you might have to be creative with. Like, I think about my time in the spinal unit. Holy moly. I mean, having to kind of like get different services involved according to the need of the patient. And I really thank Felicity to open my eyes up to what a valuable role we have in actually supporting our patients to get the hell out of hospital. This is an important role.
Oh, it absolutely is. But I also think if our job was simply to refer to a few services, what are we spending all these years of study for? Like, is that not literally a receptionist role or an administrator?
Absolutely not. And you know, and I love this provocative question, because if you had your students here, you'd be able to be debating this. But anyone who's worked in hospital social work knows it is so much more. And Felicity articulates that. She says, often
that's actually my point, Liz.
It's with the family as well, right? And it is the politics involved with the negotiations that take place. And the whole concept of dignity of risk, right? Like, we've talked about this before on our podcast. Mm. But she just referred just very briefly about one of her little case studies where there was a discharge practice, if you like.
Yes.
Knowing that it might break down, but the concept of a dignity of risk, that in fact often our role as social workers is to support the person to get out there, and if they fail, they fail.
Yeah.
But that, back to the social justice value, isn't that an enactment of it?
Absolutely. And I think that's my point in asking the provocative question, is that actually there is so much more. Discharge planning is a task or activity which is underpinned by skills and interventions, right? That's why it's that umbrella term. So I often say to students in my healthcare subject, name me the skills that you can actually see being enacted in this situation, in this role play or in this case study. Name and articulate the skills, because it is too easy for both us as well as external other disciplines and other people to be saying, well, all you do is discharge planning. And what that's doing is taking away the actual nuance and the detail around the very intensive work that is along the path to discharge. Discharge is a point in time. Discharge planning is a task to get to that point in time, but the skills and interventions actually sit underneath and around that.
And I liked the way that she talked about it as being specialist skills.
Yes.
And when she talked about the fact that, you know, just your knowledge of services and their criteria, that is like an encyclopedia that you're requiring, depending on, you know, just... If I had to actually get involved in a discharge with an older person now, I would be beside myself. But the knowledge base of those social workers that are doing this regularly is enormous. And the other thing is their relationship to not just the patient and the family, but to the services, to have that knowledge to know, I think this service would be better for these reasons. Yeah. And you want to get on with those services, because you know that if you don't get on with them, it's to the detriment of your patient too. It's very political and relational too, that role that these social workers have.
Do you remember, Liz, Pamela Trevithick's Lexicon of Skills? I think we'll put it in the show notes and get people to see where that is. But when Pamela Trevithick, she's a now retired academic in England, and she was one of the first people to really clearly articulate the skills that social workers are using in these complex interventions. And when she first published her first book on it, the lexicon had something like 15 skills. And as it went on, it expanded and expanded because social workers kept saying, but what about this? What about this? What about this? And I think that's the complexity that actually is missing when we just label something like discharge planning. We forget actually all the minutiae of the work that we're doing as we get on that path. I also wanted just to make a comment on the social justice aspect and Felicity's focus on the ethics that underpin discharge planning. Like you said, that dignity of risk. And what I really liked about the way Felicity showed three different examples was that it's actually three different ways of understanding the same idea, right? And not only does it show the nuance and complexity of different case presentations, but it also speaks to how the different ethical lenses you could take to these situations. So one may be very much about dignity of risk. Another might be very much about self-determination and autonomy of decision making. Another one might be very much about respect for persons and autonomy. And but all of those are coming under an ethical umbrella of social justice. And discharge planning in itself is actually the practice of social justice. So often when we talk about social justice, we think about it theoretically. And actually, this is a beautiful example of how we practice social justice, how we enact it with people every day.
That's beautifully said, Mim, and I think that that's great that there's that we could actually link that show notes. And the other thing, as I was listening to you, I was thinking, I am a weirdo, right? Because I really love listening to social workers talking in the office. Like, you know, they'll spend the morning on the ward, right? And then they come back, maybe grab a cuppa, and then that's when they start doing a whole lot of their discharge planning and contacting. What I love is the conversations that take place in the office where someone says things like, oh, I've got this person I'm working with at the moment, and we need to find them accommodation, or we need to find them a service that's going to allow them to get home. And then someone will pipe in and go, give this one a call because I think they've got a vacancy and they're really good for people that, you know, might require A, B, C and D. And then another one will chip in and go, yeah, actually, she's on holidays at the moment, so ask for Fred Nurk. And the recipe swapping that goes on, or the phone numbers that are worth gold because it's going to take you half an hour to try and find that, but someone will just go, here it is right here. And I think what I heard you say was, again, like social workers in the talking through the layers of the work, again, that invisibility of the work that they do, I love that Felicity shone the light on this, because often at whiteboard, you'll get the, Mrs. So-and-so is ready for discharge, full stop. But behind all that, we know that she might have spent about an hour with Mrs. So-and-so, but the hours of work now that has to take place in order to support Mrs. So-and-so to get home in the way that she wants, right?
Yeah.
It's invisible work, Mim.
It's completely. Completely. And that those conversations in the office or in the corridor or the tea room, wherever it happens, those are the vital conversations, actually. I think when you think about all those skills that social workers are using all the time, networking is such a key skill. To be able to have that conversation and say, you know what, actually I was speaking with them last week, they were telling me they were about to go on Fiji for a holiday, so I know there's someone else acting in the role this week. We're going to have to ask an extra question about who that person might be. Like, that's important, right?
I know, and this is why I love having students absorb this. So let's say they've done your health course, right?
Yeah.
And they come and do placement in a hospital, and they're sitting down and they're in the immersive space and they're listening to those kind of conversations. And then I love the fact that Felicity included a student in in discovering the, you know, in the scoping review, she's got a student partnering with her in reading various articles and writing this article themselves. And then he comes back and he says, and I'm seeing it play out now that I'm a new grad in a Gen Med ward. Yeah. I'm actually seeing it play out, and I love that, all that linking of the time with you in the classroom, then placement, then graduating, and then seeing all the threads kind of come to pass.
Yeah. I was in class the other day and was talking with students about how do you, when someone's talking to you and telling you things about their life, how do you keep an ear out for what's important for you to document and what's not? How do you make those inclusion-exclusion decisions, right? and why? What's the rationale? How are we accountable for our decisions, even in documentation, right? And in one situation, someone slipped in there, in the client in the role play had slipped in that they had a housing caseworker named Angela who they quite liked. Now, it wasn't the key bit of what they were saying, but it was slipped in. And in discussion with the students, I said to them, why is that something that your ears might prick up for? Why is that something you might remember? And they were really quickly able to say to me, because later on, we might need that bit of information. I thought, yes, yes, that's exactly right. And that's what I think social workers are so well trained to do, is to listen for the gold, right? And that's part of discharge planning, is not just what's happening in the moment, but you know that discharge planning is a process. So down the path of discharge planning, you are going to need different bits of information to support that client in whatever their plan is going forward, right? And being able to hear it and be attuned to it is such a key skill.
You know what another key skill is, Mim? Is managing expectations. You know, that I think social workers do a lot of that because people want Rolls Royce, right, for their mum, or their mum wants a Rolls Royce treatment for themselves. And we know that you're lucky if you're going to get a Mazda 3.
And so I love the metaphor.
I think it's so easy. I know when I was a new grad and a student, I'd kind of be on board with promising the world because I'd kind of heard, you know, there'd be all these different services that will support you. But it's only in the course of practice that you realise, oh dear. And back to the systems that Felicity was talking about, the reality of the environment out there and how you actually communicate that with, so that there's the expectation and the reality can kind of match up a wee bit.
Absolutely. I think homelessness is one of those areas with discharge planning where the expectation and the reality is very different.
Well, we don't, isn't it? Just, health, we're not supposed to be discharging anyone to homelessness.
And that's literally the conversation I had in the classroom the other day, Liz.
Sorry, people, but it's happening every day. Every day.
That's right. That's literally the conversation we just had. And that's where the ethics is so important, right? Because for us, we are sitting there in that dignity of risk space. We are sitting there in this self-determination space. And if you've got someone saying to you, I don't want to be leave here back to homelessness, I need another option, you are stuck between a number of really difficult systems, right? You're stuck between the hospital system, the non-government services system, the welfare system, and all of them are putting pressure on the decision-making that can now happen.
And that kind of reminds me of our last episode, right, where there was that difficult space that social worker had to actually sit in, knowing the family and the patient's wish to go to a particular – the family, really – where they wanted their person to go to, right? And she had to sit in that and support them in that, knowing the pressure and experiencing the pressure from the hospital system that this was remaining in a bed that they required. So yeah, you're right. It is that tension that social workers, and it often is social workers that have to sit with that tension.
Oh, absolutely. I don't think in a lot of hospitals they have a discharge planner position. And that's often a nurse. And I don't think they wrestle ethically in the same way with this. And I don't think they draw on 80 skills.
And I'm pretty sure it's not the orthopaedic surgeon either, Mim, quietly.
Oh, absolutely. Mm. Yeah, so I just think this was a really interesting story, and I hope that everyone was okay with the pace of speaking. But I think, as you said to me earlier, Liz, that's hospital social work.
That is. And just one other thing I just wanted to say. It is really rare that you see a hospital social worker do a scope review.
Oh, yes.
And I just think that is so special that we've actually got someone here who's done that, especially working in emergency and gen med. It's not a common thing I've seen. And I just wanted to congratulate Felicity and Lon Wynn and yourself, Mim, for being involved in the project, because it seems like it's such an important It's such an important project, and it's such a, I can't wait to read the article, actually.
Yeah, and it's so it's being considered at the moment. So once it's published, we'll also link it in the show notes. And I really want to thank Felicity as well, also for firstly bringing this idea in, up for attention. I mean, how is it possible that we haven't published on this before, social work community? But also, yes, as you say, Liz, for including a student in, for actually taking it to that next level and really bridging that research practice divide. I mean, really, when we talk about research in health, particularly, we talk about evidence-based practice, and here's Felicity creating the evidence base, and I love that.
Thank you, Felicity. Thank you, Lonwin. I think that's us for another month, don't you think, Mim?
Oh, look, I think there's so much that we could continue to say on this topic, and I know we will in other episodes.
Oh, look, for sure, for sure. But what I wanted to say to people is it feels like, if you think, it feels at the moment that our podcast episodes are featuring in health, and you think, could this be because Mim's teaching a health subject? I want you to, absolutely not. This is all about who approaches us. And so our next episode is actually in the NGO world, in NDIS world. So I want to say that to you. And, you know, like we've got family court coming up and various other social workers. But we produce and tell stories from social workers who approach us. So if you want to see more of something, someone said to me recently, there's not enough child protection in there.
Oh, yeah. Come on, child protection, social workers. Yeah. Absolutely. The other thing I would like to do is say a bit of a shout out to you, Liz, for the road trip you've been doing, going around and visiting with social workers and helping them tell their stories.
I'm loving it.
Oh, what a retirement you've got going on.
I'm loving it. I'm off to regional New South Wales in a couple of weeks and then down to Melbourne. Possibly up to Brisbane.
I love that you've got the van going. I can just see you pumping the music on the freeway, getting down to all those social workers who are out there in all those areas. I love this so much. Thank you, everyone. We hope you have a good month. We hope that the lead up into winter is not already being too stressful for you all. And we'll see you as the weather starts to change. Take care, everyone.
Thanks for listening to the Social Work Stories podcast. All of the stories we share are de-identified to respect and protect the people involved. We create this podcast because we're passionate about building the global social work community and strengthening our practice, no matter the context. If you want to help us grow the podcast tribe and continue the work we do, we would love it if you can subscribe or follow the podcast in your favorite podcast app. That way, you'll be sure to get every episode as soon as it's released. While you're in your podcast app, if you can leave us a 5-star rating and write a review, it would mean so much to us. You can connect with us on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, and LinkedIn, where you can share our posts with your friends to help spread the word. And you can always find us at our home on the web, socialworkstories.com. The Social Work Stories podcast is made by Liz Murphy, Dr. Mim Fox, Justin Stesch, Dr. Ben Joseph, and Maddie Stratton. Thanks so much for listening.